Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Welcome to the famous Salem Witch Museum. Do you believe in witches?
For most of the year, the small coastal town of Salem, Massachusetts, is just one of many quiet picture postcard New England villages. Old brick buildings, colonial-style homes gathered around town greens, and a bustling harbor. But every year during the Halloween season, tiny Salem becomes a celebrated focal point for Americans looking to trick, treat, and terrify. Allison DiMario is the director of education at the Salem Witch Museum.
From Columbus Day weekend through October 31st, Salem is unbelievable. We get very many visitors, many of them in costume. It's really an exciting place to be. I think the appeal is partly getting dressed up, being somebody that you're not ordinarily, being a little scary, and maybe being a little bit scared to go down the street and maybe not knowing what's lying behind the next tree, you know. I think we like to be scared. I think as long as we feel basically safe, we like a little bit of fear, a little bit of mystery.
Salem's annual October fame capitalizes on its dark past. In 1692, it was the site of a legendary series of witchcraft trials, which led to the hanging of 19 men and women. A 20th victim was crushed to death for refusing to answer his accusers. The Salem trials are now considered among the darkest episodes in American history. Yet today, a walk along its brick sidewalks, especially in fall, reveals a very different Salem, where amusing haunted houses, ancient graveyards, and shops full of witch-themed kitsch lie in wait for tourist dollars. Salem's fascination reaches far beyond its opportunistic association with Halloween, however. Writers as different as Nathaniel Hawthorne and Arthur Miller have found inspiration in the town's quaint architecture, its Puritan traditions, and the dark mysteries of its past.
And Salem doesn't stand alone. All over New England, writers from Shirley Jackson to H.P. Lovecraft to Stephen King have found inspiration in New England's affinity for the mysterious, the morbid, and the macabre. Maybe it arises from the Puritan and Calvinistic values of those who settled our region, from even older traditions of folklore and storytelling, or maybe it's our supposedly cursed old mansions and isolated villages, our tangled, threatening forests, or long, dark winters. Whatever it may be, old New England is a treasure trove of secrets and skeletons that writers have capitalized on for centuries. Coming up on Storylines New England, we look at the region's scarifying underside, its myths, its folklore, and its unexplained, along with a blockbuster book by America's greatest contemporary horror meister, who, not coincidentally, is a native New Englander from Maine. Once again, the Salem Witch Museum's Allison DiMario.
I think New England has a tradition of being a dramatic place. There are extremes of season, say. I mean, we can get very cold and snowy in the winter and can be very hot in the summer. There's also a tradition of old ghost stories and old events that pique people's curiosity. I mean, people still come here looking for ghosts, looking for ghost stories. Authors like Stephen King, I think, look back to the early history of the region or even the way it is today and find it to be a place very conducive to scary stories.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. But Storylines is more than just a show about books. Each week, we'll address a particular New England author's work and look at the issues that each book raises as we search for insights about where we've been, where we are now, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines, a look at New England's dark underside through Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
Near the beginning of Salem's Lot, Stephen King quotes a fictional article from Maine's largest newspaper, the Portland Press Herald. It seems as if something has happened to the tiny town of Jerusalem's Lot. The town has basically vanished. The buildings still stand, but it seems that every single inhabitant of this insular Yankee village has either moved away or simply disappeared into thin air.
Jerusalem's Lot is a small town east of Cumberland and 20 miles north of Portland. It is not the first town in American history to just dry up and blow away, and will probably not be the last, but it is one of the strangest. If a man wanted to spin out his retirement in a small country town where everyone minded his own business and the big event of any given week was apt to be the ladies' auxiliary bake-off, then the Lot would have been a good choice. But a little over a year ago, something began to happen in Jerusalem's Lot that was not usual. People began to drop out of sight. The larger proportion of these naturally haven't disappeared in the real sense of the word at all. The Lot's former constable, Parkins Gillespie, is living with his sister in Kittery. Charles James, owner of a gas station across from the drugstore, is now running a repair shop in neighboring Cumberland. The list of undisappearances could go on and on. What is mystifying about these found people is their unanimous unwillingness or inability to talk about Jerusalem's Lot and what, if anything, might have happened there.
As the novel unfolds, we learn the truth about Jerusalem's Lot. It's been invaded by vampires. But Stephen King's vampires aren't those black-caped, romantic, Transylvanian-accented stereotypes. Instead, they're disguised as common, perfectly plausible outsiders, particularly for New England. They're antique dealers from away who come to the town to live and set up shop. But once the sun goes down, these ingratiating retailers prey on the naive Yankee townspeople until they begin to turn into vampires themselves.
Stephen King wrote Salem's Lot in 1975, influenced not just by Bram Stoker's 1897 classic Dracula, but also by modern horror comics like Tales from the Crypt. He found himself wondering what would happen if Dracula came to Maine, partly because it's the author's home state, but also because the place seemed somehow appropriate as a setting for this kind of tale. King once said, "There are so many small towns in Maine, towns which remain so isolated that almost anything could happen there. People could drop out of sight, disappear, perhaps even come back from the dead." This idea that New England is full of odd, hidden corners where unspeakable things might take root is a very old one, and it provides Salem's Lot with the same whiff of credence that many other New England writers of the macabre and the mysterious have employed.
Old towns hold tight to their secrets, blending them into a dark stew of history, occult belief, Puritan guilt, and folklore that passes from generation to generation, always reshaping itself to suit the times, but never quite disappearing. Even our baseball team, the Boston Red Sox, was truly thought to be cursed, at least until last week, by a hex that started in 1920 when the team sold its star, Babe Ruth, to those damned Yankees. Before their astounding World Series victory, superstitious fans did everything from burning the Bambino's eyebrows to wearing the same underwear for weeks so that the gods of baseball might release the region from its 86-year nightmare. When the team finally laid the curse to rest, 3.5 million New Englanders, the largest crowd ever gathered here, converged on Boston to offer thanks for their deliverance. It's the way we work here in New England, a region prone to secrets, the supernatural, and occasional outbreaks of hysteria. Whether it's baseball or witchcraft, the fascination remains the same.
Today on Storylines New England, we're looking at Stephen King's Salem's Lot, as well as other morbid and macabre literature of our region, as a way to explore New England's psychology and its dark underside. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. What is it about our region that lends itself to ghosts and goblins and things that go bump in the night? What drives it? What is it about New England, its landscape, its people, and its traditions that make it so appealing to Gothic writers from Hawthorne to Lovecraft to Shirley Jackson? Ardent Red Sox fan Stephen King, well, there's no surprise there, is there? is hard at work on a new book about this year's team, and he couldn't join us for the show this week, but we want to hear your favorite story of New England's dark underside. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is Joseph Citro, a writer, NPR commentator, and author of several books on our region's dark side, including his latest, Cursed in New England. And Joe Citro, great to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
From her home in Norwich, Connecticut, is Faye Ringel, professor of English at the Coast Guard Academy and author of New England Gothic Literature, History and Folklore of the Supernatural. Faye Ringel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Laura. Glad to be here.
Faye, I want to start with you and definitely get you in on this too, Joe. But Faye, first, what aspects of New England's culture do our Gothic writers draw from? What is it about this region that provides them with so much great material?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, for one thing, there's certainly years and years of existing ghost story traditions. We have traditions of ghost stories going back to the first European settlers. But more than that, we have the episodes of hysteria. We have the Salem witch trials. But before that, there were a number of witch trials in Massachusetts and in Connecticut that people know less about. There was a very strong witch belief all through the 17th century and into the 18th century. So that's an inspiration. But for the other, it's just that darkness, those secrets, those things we'd like to keep hidden but which keep bubbling up into the light somehow.
Joe, what would you add to that?
Well, I would add that it all began with the first Puritans who arrived here, and belief in the supernatural is essential to belief in the horrific and the Gothic. The Puritans who arrived here had sort of a fire and brimstone religion. They believed in devils and demons, and they thought they would find them here among the trees. They identified the Native Americans as devils, and they imagined other monsters lurking in the darkness just beyond the light of the campfire. I think we've been frightened from the start. There was an era when we first settled one farm very distant from the next, when people would sit alone in the darkness and imagine, and often the imaginings were dark. There was later a tradition of tall tales, yarnin', as it was called, where people would compete to create horrific stories. These were probably the precursors to people like Hawthorne and Stephen King and Shirley Jackson, people who would sit around the hearth and spin tales. And a lot of those tales have taken root and have become confused with fact.
That tradition of finding fear in the landscape itself, Faye Ringel, is really something that's pretty old in New England literature, isn't it? I mean, with the characterization of the land as a howling wilderness by early Puritan writers. But I wanted to ask you where you think Stephen King fits in with his tradition of macabre writing. Is he a logical endpoint or a logical contemporary inheritor of these old traditions of writing?
I believe that he certainly is. He's very much aware of his predecessors, of Hawthorne and of H.P. Lovecraft. And in fact, his nonfiction work, Danse Macabre, lays out pretty definitely his debt to those earlier New England writers, as well as to those yarners and tall tale tellers that he grew up hearing in his own family in Maine, or the old guy sitting around the stove who figure in Salem's Lot. He certainly knew about all of those. But he's also someone who has studied literature. He's someone who was an English major in college, got a master's degree, taught English. So he's very aware of the New England literary tradition. What makes him different from his predecessors, though, is that he came from a blue collar background. What he really brought to horror stories is what you might call that blue collar sensibility. He wanted to tell the New England horror stories not from the perspective of one of the aristocrats, but of the perspective of the ordinary people.
That's fascinating. And King mentions a lot of other writers in the course of Salem's Lot too, doesn't he? He mentions Shirley Jackson. He mentions Grace Metalius. He certainly displays his knowledge of his predecessors in many different ways. Joe Citro, New England horror writing, and particularly Stephen King's writing in Salem's Lot, has a very strong religious strain in it, doesn't it? Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I think that's one of the points of entry where a writer of horror fiction can enter the world of the reader. Anyone who's had any sort of religious upbringing, whether it's Protestant, Catholic, or something else, is predisposed to believe in the supernatural. So there's maybe a built-in belief about gods and devils and possibly the attendant demons. So with religious themes, the writer is halfway there to involving the reader in the narrative. King goes pretty far in that direction sometimes. He actually has religious icons, talking statues, things like that.
And yet, Joe, New England today is one of the least religious parts of the country. We have very, very low rates of church going.
I don't know that, but I would certainly count myself among those who don't attend.
Faye, you want to comment?
Yes. Actually, King said several times that when he was reworking Dracula, what he wanted to make clear was that the religious forces were not successful because the believers were not strong enough. I mean, he was trying to imagine what would happen in a culture where maybe people believe in the existence of evil, but they don't believe strongly enough in the power of God and religion to overcome them. Only a very few characters are able to draw on that power.
Faye, one of the most frightening pieces of New England literature I've ever read is not a horror story at all. It's actually Jonathan Edwards' 1740 sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
Yes.
This piece of sermonizing, possibly one of the most famous sermons ever preached in America, is almost as scary as any horror story ever written, with its imagery of God holding the human soul over a burning flame as a spider on a web. Do you think that this religious tradition of fear of hell, fear of the imminence of instant death, is built into an awful lot of New England horror writing?
Oh, I think it certainly is. And there's always that dialogue between those old beliefs and the modern-day skepticism, because at least Edwards held out the possibility that that God might spare you. But if you don't believe anymore, then what is going to protect you from the powers of evil?
Yeah.
1-800-892-6477 is our number on Storylines New England. This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner. And today we're exploring New England's haunted shadows with Stephen King's book Salem's Lot. We want to hear from you. What mysterious tales are whispered in your town? And what do you think it is about New England that makes this such a good place for writing and contemplating the dark side? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We want the stories from your community. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. From Vermont Public Radio, Joe Citro is with us. He's a writer, NPR commentator, and author of several books, including Cursed in New England. And joining us from Norwich, Connecticut, Faye Ringel, professor of English at the Coast Guard Academy and author of New England Gothic Literature, History and Folklore of the Supernatural. One more time, the number to join us with your stories of the supernatural or the downright spooky in your town, 1-800-892-6477. And Joe Citro, I want to move ahead now with you and tell us what tales of doom are still lurking around New England today.
Well, a wonderful story that ties into that tradition of yarnin is one that is, it's an old Vermont story of the hibernating hill folk. The story is that there were a certain impoverished hill family somewhere north of Montpelier, Vermont, who didn't have enough food supply to stretch through the winter. So they would take the elderly and infirm, and according to some arcane ritual, which has since been lost, would drug them and freeze them and let them pass the winter in hibernation, only to be thawed out again in the spring, and then they would join the family.
And where is this supposed to take place, Joe, again?
It takes place in northern Vermont, somewhere north of Montpelier.
Now, there's another good one from northern Vermont, the monster that's like the Loch Ness Monster in Vermont's Lake Champlain.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, that's, we call it Champ, named after the lake's founder, Samuel Champlain. And it is apparently, a cousin of the Loch Ness Monster. There are several sightings every year of a serpentine head and neck, and occasionally people will have kind of face-to-face run-ins with this thing. There have been photographs taken. As recently as last year, there were some underwater recordings that were made where the instruments were detecting biosonar. Now, there's nothing in the lake that produces biosonar. That would take a whale or a dolphin. So they were recording something in the lake that should not be in the lake. So every year, this idea that the monster in the lake, every year it gets realer and realer.
Well, Joe, one more. I've heard that there are supposedly areas throughout New England that are cursed. Now, such as where and why and how?
Oh, sure. Well, this ties back to what you were talking about, or what the reader was talking about, Salem's Lot, how some villages just sort of dry up and blow away for one reason or another. And the New England hills are just dotted with these. Among the most famous, I think, is probably Dudleytown in Connecticut, which has the reputation for being a cursed village, that by the 1920s, all the citizens of Dudleytown had met with sinister ends. Those people who tried to escape were sort of struck down in their tracks, and those people who remained only to suffer and die. Here in Vermont, we have another area on Glastonbury Mountain near Bennington, which has a similar reputation. During the late 40s and early 50s, from 7 to 11 people vanished there without a trace, as if they had just stepped off the earth. But before that, the region had a reputation for monster sightings and ghost sightings and generally an uncomfortable place that was avoided by the Native Americans, settled by the Europeans, and then abandoned as if in fear.
Faye Ringel, how about your favorites, your favorite stories of doom around New England today?
Well, just to add to the Dudleytown one, when I was there doing some research, they had been so overwhelmed by visitors that there was a large sign posted in their town hall that said, "Please do not come. There are no ghosts, no spirits, and no curse." And so, which just shows the potency of that. I think that the Black Dog of the Hanging Hills in Meriden is an interesting one. It's one that climbers still tell each other, and that supposedly there is a black dog that is sometimes seen in the picturesquely named Hanging Hills, which are very steep rocks that attract a lot of climbers near Meriden, Connecticut, and that if you see it three times, it's doom. And certainly every year a climber tends to disappear, and then they'll say that he has seen the black dog.
Wow.
So that's one of my favorites.
King, of course, in Salem's Lot takes advantage of this tradition of a cursed place, or a place that somehow spreads its evil among the people who enter there, with his description of what goes on in the Marston House. Faith, does he do any other things that take advantage of longstanding cursed or doomed traditions, either in New England lore or literature?
Oh, he certainly does. The book It is his tribute to his current residence of Bangor. And, in fact, he pretty much exhausts all of the horrible stories that have ever been told about Bangor. Most every story in the history of Derry in It is a story that has been told about Bangor, Maine. Everything from the racist killings to the persecution of homosexuals to various, about everything except the monster in the sewer that comes and takes the kids.
That's great. We're going to take a phone call now, Faye and Joe. And this is Pete from Jericho, Vermont. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. Oh my gosh. I just saw a black dog run in front of me.
As long as you didn't see it three times, you're fine.
And you're not in Connecticut, Pete. You're okay.
Hey, happy Halloween, everybody.
You
Thank
too.
You.
Been enjoying the show immensely. I was wondering if the steamed attendees in the studio tonight could tell us a little bit about the legend of Shikoro. That thing just, that legend scares me. And
I bet Joe Citro knows something about that.
I'm sorry, but I didn't even hear the question.
This is the legend of Shikarawa.
Ah, is that also pronounced Shakarura?
I bet it is somewhere.
That's the New Hampshire legend?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another curse story.
Uh-huh.
And that was a story that's so poignant that certain writers have chosen not to tell it. I didn't let that stop me. That's included in Cursed in New England.
What is the story,
Joe? But it has
Joe?
To do with an Indian who makes friends with a settler by the name of Cornelius Campbell. And they become very good friends. And when the Indian, Chakarura, goes to St. Francis to visit the tribe, he leaves his son in the care of Cornelius Campbell and his family. The young Indian boy has been fascinated by the European cooking, and he likes some of the sweet jellies that Mrs. Campbell has prepared. And he finds something and samples it, and it turns out to be not jam or jelly, but some variety of poison. When Chakarura comes back, he finds that his son is dead, and he can't believe that the Campbells were not responsible for murdering him. He slaughters the Campbells' family, leaving Mr. Campbell alive to chase him. He tracks him down to the top of Chakarura Peak, and before he dies, he curses the area so that nothing will grow. And as if there were a true collision with the preternatural, people start getting sick and dying. Cattle and other livestock become ill. It's as if the curse really worked. And historically, there was some sort of contagion that affected the livestock and the people of that area. Something happened. It was as if Chakarura somehow summoned from the earth some kind of poison that wiped out the living things there.
Now, Pete, in Vermont, why is this one of your favorites?
Oh, just getting up into the high peaks and doing a lot of climbing, the White Mountains, Chakarua, I always called it Chakarua, always is just such an impressive peak, and to know that there was a legend that was associated with the mountain always intrigued me.
Well, Pete, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you. One last question for Joe.
Sure.
The exclamation point at the end of the sentence, at least in climbing lore, is that Campbell chased Chakarua up to the top of Mount Chakarua, and before succumbing to his death, a death that he brought on himself, he threw himself off the top of that mountain.
Right,
That's the part that brings it home.
Right.
Well, it's a little fuzzy whether he was shot or whether he threw himself off, but apparently one or the other.
Mm. All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Pete. I appreciate it. And I think it raises something that both of you mentioned earlier, a long tradition of storytelling started by the Indians. There's a lot of their folklore that ties into some of what we're talking about today on Storylines New England. Coming up after break, more on New England's macabre underside through Stephen King's book Salem's Lot. We'll take more of your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
If you want more information on Storylines New England or the books we're reading, why don't you visit our website, storylinesala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and they have our discussion guides, too. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand who we are as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today we're looking at New England's dark secrets and mystical places, and at Stephen King's novel, Salem's Lot. King's blockbuster is the story of an isolated Maine village called Jerusalem's Lot and its horrifying demise at the hands and fangs of a vampire who comes to town. Far from the standard "I want to suck your blood" sort of vampire, he's a polite and congenial older man who moves to Maine to sell antiques, then roams the woods and streets of Jerusalem's Lot after dark, turning its Yankee townsmen and women into vampires themselves. The book plays on ancient and familiar fears of haunted mansions, small insular villages with large skeletons in dark closets, and murky forests that give us that instinctive feeling that someone is there, hiding, watching, and waiting.
A branch snapped somewhere behind them, almost stealthily. The daylight was nearly gone from the sky. The trees were dark, bulking presences all around them, moving slowly in the night breeze, rubbing together, creaking in their joints. Another branch snapped off to their left. Ralphie shrieked, "I see it! I see the ghost! I see it!" Terror like hot iron leaped into Danny's chest. Wires seemed to have run up his legs. He would have turned and run, but Ralph was clutching him. "Where?" he whispered, forgetting that he had invented the ghost.
"It's gone now, but I saw him. It. Eyes. I saw eyes. Oh, Danny!"
He was blubbering. "There ain't no ghost, you fool. Come on." Danny held his brother's hand, and they began to walk. His legs felt as if they were made up of 10,000 pencil erasers. His knees were trembling. Ralphie was crowding against him, almost forcing him off the path.
"It's watching us," Ralphie whispered. "Can you feel it?"
Danny stopped. And in the way of children, he did feel something, and knew they were no longer alone. "Run," he said harshly. But Ralphie trembled beside him in a paralysis of fear. His grip on Danny's hand was as tight as baling wire. His eyes stared into the woods, and then began to widen.
"Danny!"
A branch snapped. Danny turned and looked where his brother was looking. The darkness enfolded them.
Stephen King is just one of a host of writers of horror, mystery, and the morbid who have called New England home. Authors like Shirley Jackson, H.P. Lovecraft, and Nathaniel Hawthorne have drawn their settings from New England's landscape and their characters from the region's potent mix of superstitious Yankees, guilt-driven Puritans, and isolated villagers. Today on Storylines New England, we're looking at the New England underside through the pages of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, as well as the haunted traditions of New England in its history, its psychology, and in its literature. And we want to hear from you. Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. What is it about New England that lends itself so well to the occult and the strange? Do you have a favorite story of New England's haunted side? Again, the number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Our guests today are Joe Citro. He's a fiction writer, actually a writer of all kinds of things, an NPR commentator, and he's the author of Cursed in New England. He's talking to us from Vermont Public Radio. And we also have Faye Ringel. She's a professor of English at the Coast Guard Academy. She's the author of New England Gothic Literature, History and Folklore of the Supernatural. And Faye Ringel, and very early on in Salem's Lot, we have Stephen King showing us that children have a special sensitivity to the presence of horror, the presence of the otherworldly. And that reminds us that the Salem witch trials themselves, those famous and awful trials at the end of the 17th century, were initiated in some ways by the revelations of a group of children. Is that sensitivity of children a special feature of New England Gothic literature? And but does it also, and this is sort of the second part of the question, Faye, does it also oversimplify the kinds of the kind of complexity that attended those trials?
Well, It's actually more of a feature of late 20th century Gothic literature. The special role of children is not specifically in New England, but you do find it in all over 20th century horror and in some of the famous British horror fiction of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But I think of Henry James, The Turn of the Screw. But certainly, it's not at all similar to what happened in Salem. What happened in Salem was amazingly complex. It's been perplexing people ever since. Mm. And though the first of the possessed girls, the young girls who began to accuse others of being their tormentor, although these first girls were only 9 and 12 years old, the circle of accusing girls, we would say, were more like young women. Many of them were up to age 20 and 22. What they were, of course, was unmarried, and they still had the status of children.
Right, right. Joe Citro, do you see a special role for? Do you think that Salem witch trials were an anomaly in this sense of involving or appearing to be instigated by children? Do you agree with Faye that the special sensitivity of children to the other side, so to speak, is a feature of 20th century relationships to horror?
Well, I think there are two very separate issues, and the Salem witch trials is maybe an anomaly. But what seems to have been propelling it was approval. The little girls, the more they fantasized, the more they accused, the more approval they won for themselves. And I think probably that is a facet of all of us, but particularly it's a facet of young people. The need for approval. It was a perverse sort of approval that they were getting, but still it was allowing them to continue their accusations. It wasn't unique to Salem. I mean, there were accused witches in the other colonies. More witches were hanged from Andover than from Salem. So, I mean, it wasn't a neat little cluster that we imagine it to be. It was kind of a contagion. The witch spotters, as I guess you might call them, were brought from town to town. They were brought over to Andover. They were brought to Marblehead, and somehow they would just pick people out of the crowd and say, "Ha ha, he or she is a witch."
This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy, along with Kevin Garter, and today we're talking about the mysterious, the unexplained, the downright horrifying tales and legends from our region. Our guests are Joe Citro and Faye Ringle. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to go to Burlington, Vermont next. Shannon joins us from there. Hi, Shannon. You're on Storylines New England. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I just had a little question, but first I just was wondering, I was thinking about maybe perhaps the reasons maybe that, you know, Vermont and New England in particular have this sort of tradition of storytelling and ghost stories. And I was thinking, you know, I know just for myself, as a child, I spent a lot more time, you know, telling stories, sharing stories. There's less TV, and I feel like we're more of a rural sort of area. There's less of that sort of filling our, you know, day-to-day lives with, you know, commercials, stuff like that. And so I thought that might be a particular, you know, element. But also, I was particularly drawn to Barataro Retreat, which I know has a pretty old history. And I went there and visited, and I just felt like the energy there was incredible. And I was wondering, you know, what sort of history that had, and if you had any information on that.
Joe Citro, you're in Vermont. Do you know anything
right.
What Shannon is talking about?
Well, the Brattleboro Retreat was, I guess, the first private mental institution in this state. And I'm not sure quite what energy you're talking about. I know there are a lot of spooky stories associated with the Brattleboro Retreat. One of my favorites has to do with a tower that was built on a hill overlooking the retreat. It was built because the doctors thought putting the patients to work would have therapeutic value, so they put them to work making this sort of Gothic tower on a hill. And it's there. It stands there to this day, but no one makes much of a big deal out of it because as soon as the thing was built, the patients started using it as a cliff from which to jump to commit suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And the ghost stories that lurk around the tower are kind of interesting. They, too, are unique because people don't see ghosts on the tower or below the tower. The ghosts that they claim to see are falling, tumbling off the tower. So they see ghosts in flight, ghosts in the process of making their final descent.
Faye Ringel, what do you think about Shannon's comment that the rural life itself is more conducive to storytelling around the fire?
Oh, she's absolutely right. H.P. Lovecraft often said that for the epicure and the terrible, there's nothing like an isolated New England farmhouse. In Lovecraft's The Picture in the House, which is one of his marvelous short stories set in rural New England. And she's certainly right in that the older traditions were preserved in the rural areas. Most of these stories that we're recounting and such significantly don't come from Hartford or Fall River or Lowell. I mean, they tend to come from the backwoods areas.
I guess this is a good place, Faye, to note that the Irish poet Patrick Cullum also claimed that the end of the great eras of storytelling came when the electric light was invented.
Mm.
Well, Stephen King wrote his vampire novel Salem's Lot with a great appreciative awareness, I guess we've established, of Stoker's Dracula and also more modern things, nail-biting comic books like Tales from the Crypt. But he was perhaps unaware that New England has an actual history of vampirism, because for almost a century, starting in the late 1700s, there have been a handful of documented cases of vampires, or at least what were thought to be vampires, that appeared from Vermont to Rhode Island. And these were taken so seriously that New Englanders actually exhumed bodies for ritual vampire killings. And these rituals included the burning of the blood-filled heart, or even the entire body, believe it or not. We're going to be joined now by Rhode Island state folklorist Michael Bell, who's written a whole book about this. The book is called Food for the Dead, On the Trail of New England's Vampires, and it explores the history and folklore of these vampire cases right here in New England. And Michael Bell is joining us now. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks. It's great to have you. Michael Bell, when exactly do we start to, do New Englanders really start to believe that there are actual vampires among us? Tell us a little bit about this story.
Well, the first case I found, which doesn't mean it's the very first, this is the first one that's come to light and that I've discovered, was 1793 in Manchester, Vermont. And it continues for a good 100 years, up to 1892. The last case that I've found is in Exeter, Rhode Island.
And what was it, Michael? This is Laura Canoy here. What was it that made people think that there were vampires among them?
Well, at this time, New England was in the grip of a very terrible tuberculosis epidemic, which they called consumption. To them, it was a mysterious ailment because they didn't really understand how it was contagious, although they were aware that it was contagious. It would kill one family member after another. After the medical doctors, or whatever passed for a doctor at those times, said that I'm sorry, there's nothing more I can do. It's now in the hands of God. Some of them turned to an old folk remedy, which is to go to the cemetery, exhume the bodies of the members of the family who had died, and see which ones were not what you would expect after they'd been buried for some time without being embalmed. Usually that was fresh blood in the heart, which was liquid blood, and they interpreted it as fresh blood. And there are variations, since it's a folk practice, either cutting the heart out, burning it to ashes, sometimes feeding the ashes to sick family members who were in medicine, like water perhaps even, or maybe burning the entire corpse and having those who were sick stand around and inhale the smoke as a kind of curative.
Now, Michael, did these traditions come over with them from England? Were they older European traditions, or was
well,
this something
really
they...
that's really the question.
Uh-huh.
It's very difficult to make the connection with this tradition to Great Britain, since this tradition was never strong in Great Britain, in England. It's strongest in Eastern Europe. It's identical in Eastern Europe, in fact.
I see.
So how it got to New England in at least as early as the late 18th century is is right now still a good question.
Now, all of this happened, Michael, before the famous book by Bram Stoker that actually named Dracula and called him a vampire. Did these people even use the word vampire?
Well, that's a good question. In my book, I concluded that it was really the outsiders who were commenting on this event.
I see.
Historians, journalists, and so on, who said, you know, the people involved don't really know it by its rightful term.
Mm-hmm.
It's really vampirism that they're practicing, but they don't call it that. They're not aware of that. But then, about a year after I completed the book, I found a tombstone in northern Rhode Island that has the words consumption and vampire engraved on them.
Wow.
So I've got to ask myself, it says, although consumption's vampire grasp had seized thy mortal frame, and then the last lines are covered with cement. Someone's tried to steal the stone. It dates from 1841. So whether that's metaphorical, consumption's vampire grasp, you're dying and you look like a vampire because consumption is consuming you and you're becoming a walking corpse.
But it also implies that...
literal.
Right. It implies that the disease itself is the monster.
Well, it was, actually. In truth, it really was the disease that was the monster, that was the vampire, that was killing people.
Michael Bell, one last question for you. What is it that keeps drawing people back to this theme of vampires again and again? You know, we have this history that you've told us about, all sorts of novels throughout New England's history. We're talking about a contemporary novel, Stephen King's Salem's Lot, today. What do you think, as someone who studies this, that it is about vampires that just makes us so fascinated by them?
Well, I think there are a lot of different elements that really lead to the attractiveness of the vampire figure. One is just it's so frightening to think that you believe someone is dead, but the person's not really dead. They're undead.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it brings in the whole issue of, you know, when is death, when do we know someone's dead? How do we know someone's dead? When are we dead? And that, you know, that's been an issue. It's still an issue with our heart-lung machines and our brain death, and we still don't know what truly when the line between life and death is. So that always keeps things attractive. And then when it gets into the literary realm, you have vampires who are all-powerful, who travel widely, who are aristocratic, you know, who are sexually attractive, at least in the literary and the television and the movie vampires. So that also is very attractive, of course.
Well, Michael Bell, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. Michael Bell, Rhode Island state folklorist and author of Food for the Dead, On the Trail of New England Vampires.
You are listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner with Laura Canoy, and we are talking about the mysterious, the unexplained, the downright horrifying tales and legends from our region. And we're going to take another call right now. Our guests are Joe Citro and Faye Ringel. This is Scott from Saratoga, New York. Hi, Scott.
Hi,
welcome to Storylines.
You? Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wondering why the Amityville Horror wasn't mentioned yet.
Well, for one reason, it happened in Long Island, I believe.
Okay.
Was that where the house was in Long Island?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But you know, I'm glad you brought that up because the Amityville Horror was investigated by a couple of people from Connecticut, of all places, actually, I think I'm going to ask Joe Citro to comment on that.
Okay. Well, I sort of enjoy talking about the Amityville Horror because I think it's more appropriately called the Amityville Hoax.
Remind us what it was first, Joe, because my memory's fading on this one.
Well, it was a house on Long Island in Amityville, Long Island, where a guy by the name of Ronald DeFeo murdered his family. And the next people who bought it, George Lutz and his wife, left within 2 weeks, claiming that they had been frightened away by all sorts of not ghostly but demonic activity in the house. It was a story that was kind of cooked up between the Lutzes, who really couldn't pay for the house, Ronald DeFeo's defense attorney, who needed a defense and somehow thought claiming the devil made me do it might work, and the poor sap writer, Jay Anson, who never visited the house and wrote what was, in effect, a novel called The Amityville Horror, which caught on, sold millions of copies, and spawned a series of god-awful motion pictures.
That's great. Just quickly in passing, it should be noted that the investigators of the Amityville Horror were a couple of folks from Connecticut named Lorraine and Ed Warren, who are very famous in supernatural discovery circles. Their claims are fulsomely demonstrated on the internet, as is a rebuttal of all their claims by a wonderful outfit known as the New England Skeptical Society. But Fay Ringel, I wanted to ask you, when this kind of event, these kinds of things make their way into literature, whether it's way back in the day of Hawthorne or as contemporary as Stephen King, what is it these writers are really after? Are they trying to explore hidden worlds for us, or are they really just using macabre and morbid writing as a way to get after what most writers are after, which is an exploration of what people are, who they are, and why they do what they do?
Well, I would say all of the above. But certainly both King and Hawthorne were more interested in the workings of the human heart laid bare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is what interested them, regardless of what they write about. And that's why both King and Hawthorne wrote plenty of non-supernatural fiction as well as supernatural fiction. On the other hand, New England's most perhaps characteristic horror writer, H.P. Lovecraft, was supremely uninterested in human beings. He said over and over again that humans did not interest him. He hated the fiction of writers who cared about human beings. What he cared about was that slightly heard whispering at the edge of consciousness, that sense of something dreadful trying to get in.
You know, Fay, I want to ask you something that we asked Michael Bell, who was the author of Food for the Dead on the Trail of New England Vampires. I'm curious what you think. What is it about this theme of vampires that keeps us coming back again?
Well, what keeps us coming back, as he said very well, is not the New England folkloristic vampire, not the idea that great Aunt Mary can't rest easy in the grave, so she comes back and chokes you in the night and gives you tuberculosis. I mean, that's not attractive, and that's not the kind of thing that that horror writers care to write about. I mean, it's significant that that even since the discoveries of the New England vampire episodes, there's been little to no fiction using those folkloristic vampires. On the other hand, the vampire of literature is marvelous. The vampire of literature combines everything, sex, death, and these days rock and roll.
You know, and Joe Citro, a question for you. We heard about the vampire tradition here in New England, very interesting part of our history that I was unaware of until we started getting ready for the show today. I have also heard, though, Joe Citro, that there's a werewolf tradition, too, in New England. Now, have you heard of that?
Well, I've heard of it, but I haven't really tracked it down. I suspect it's up in this neck of the woods, anyway, kind of a hand-me-down from the French-Canadian population. The loup-garou. But I think there are a number of traditions that kind of get confused. The werewolf, the Bigfoot, the Wendigo, they're all these kind of man-like, hairy critters.
Bigfoot, then? Have we had Bigfoot stories around here, Joe?
Yes, we have many.
Mm.
Yeah, that's there are many Bigfoot stories in New England. Again, that's one of those creatures that lurks just beyond the tree line.
Fay, do you know anything about werewolves in New England?
Yes, certainly the loup-garou, the French werewolf, not only came over with the later Canadian French immigrants, but maybe even with the very earliest ones. In fact, there's even a mention in Cotton Mather's The Magnalia Christi, in which he calls a living Indian at that time a hideous loup-garou, claiming that he was a shapeshifter. And certainly the Indian shaman would go into trances and would narrate the beast totem stories, and maybe the colonists thought that they would literally transform themselves into beasts.
And Joe Citro, one more sort of man-beast question for you. The pig man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's one of those stories that, as far as I could tell, is unique to Vermont. As far as I can tell, I'm the only one who's ever written about it.
And
it's one of those stories. It's one of those stories that escaped the mass media, so it never became widely known, like Champ or like the Jersey Devil, or like the Mothman, or the Dover Demon. These are all critters, mysterious critters that have somehow been picked up by the media and sort of spread throughout the country. Our local pigman never had that distinction. This is a critter that had a brief reign in Northfield, Vermont, in the early 70s. Got a lot of people wicked scared. appeared to a number of individuals, a number of couples, appeared in a number of backyards, rooting around in people's aluminum trash cans, and then all of a sudden disappeared. All the descriptions seemed to match, that he was man-sized from 5'8 to 5'10, that he walked on two legs like a man, that he was naked, covered with light or white hair, but had the hideous face of a pig.
Wow.
That's the pigman.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, just quickly, Faye Ringel, there's so much here to talk about. We could probably spend another 3 hours on this subject, but I just want to ask you quickly. We've touched a little bit on the way that science and technology and a kind of new technical rationalism has pushed away some of the old traditions, the old folklore. As that has happened in the 20th century and up to our own day, have we lost anything?
I don't think so. We just heard about the Warrens and the Amityville Horror, mm-hmm. The fact is that belief in something seems to be stronger than ever. There's a saying that if people stop believing in God, it's not that they believe in nothing, it's they start to believe in anything. We have, since the 60s, a huge outpouring of beliefs in angels, in New Age, in possession. There are probably more exorcisms going on today than there were in the 18th century. I think that there's a huge anti-rational rebellion, and the popularity of Halloween. The popularity of Halloween really just brings it all home.
Well, Joe Citro and Faye Ringel, thank you so much for joining us on Storylines today. It's just been great to have both of you here.
Thank you, and happy Halloween.
thank you,
and be safe.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org or visit your local public library. Many libraries in your area will have copies of the books and program schedules, tapes of our past shows, and even discussion guides.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan and Rebecca Kaufman. Our readings came from the Salem's Lot audiobook read by Ron McLarty. Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zalis. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, old home traditions, small town idealism, and Edith Wharton's novella, Summer.
Wharton's classic was one of the first American novels to deal with a woman's sexual awakening. But it also keenly observes class conflict and other disruptions in a rural New England under pressure from growth and an influx of outsiders.
We'll look at the transformation of rural New England through the pages of Edith Wharton's Summer on the next Storylines New England.